now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah!
See, a United States astral robot becomes a creature of death.
Oh. And babes.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain! Back to the House of Pain!
Welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast. From classic to cults and all the cheese in between, the movies are B, Bjorn Him and his grade A. And I'm your host, Mr. Jason Giaconetti, and I'm joined with my dad, Mr. Al Giaconetti.
Hey, Jay, how you doing? We got a good one today, boy.
Yeah, we do. This is the December one. We're talking about The Crawling Eye, 1958, and we'll get to it right after this.
This alarm fills the night with terror. For high on a mountainside, a mysterious red fear such as no human being has ever seen before.
Where there are mountains, there are always clouds.
But this one remains static. On the side of the Trollenberg, it never moves.
Freak of nature.
A radioactive freak of nature?
It strikes without warning, wreaking death and destruction too horrible to behold. A force of evil that tortures its victims and hurls them mercilessly to the brink of murder and madness. What is it? And what does it crave, this creeping horror that hungers and thrives on human flesh while it inhabits its own silent world that no man can penetrate? No one is safe from its spell of destruction. A cold, hypnotic stare striking fear into the hearts of all, creating a frenzied nightmare for those who behold it.
The cloud is splitting up.
Splitting up.
There are four of them now, and all moving this way.
The Crawling Eye was released October 7th, 1958 in the UK with a running time of 84 minutes. Now, it's also known as the Trollenberg Terror, which I think is actually the better name for this movie because The Crawling Eye is a little misleading about what this movie is about. It was directed by Quentin Lawrence, produced by Bobby Baker and Monty Berman, written by Jimmy Sangster. Now, Jimmy Sangster, there's a name. Those of you who like your Hammer movies, he's the Hammer writer.
Yep.
And it's based on the story by Peter Kay. Now, and you say, well, if it was written by Jimmy Sangster, how's it based on a different guy's story? Well, the story Peter Kay came up with was based on the 1956 TV series of the same name, The Trollenberg Terror. And this was the big screen, quote-unquote, remake. Starring Forrest Tucker. That's a name that most people know as Sergeant O'Rourke from F Troop. He's also in
Abominable Snowman
with the Himalayas and stuff like that. But let's be honest, he's Sergeant O'Rourke when you hear that name. There's Lawrence Payne. He was Sexton Blake. That's a TV show from 67 to 71. That's his best known work. And then Jennifer Jane was from They Came From Outer Space, 1967. That was her other one. Came after this, obviously, about a decade after this. The production company was Tempian Films, and it was distributed by Euros Films Limited in the UK and by Distributors Corporation of America. Can there be any more generic name? Distributors Corporation of America. All right. Our story opens on a Swiss mountain, Trollenberg, where one of three student climbers is suddenly killed, with his head ripped from his body. We cut to a train where two sisters, Anne and Sarah, are a London mind-reading act, and they're traveling to Geneva when Anne faints on the train, and she just takes a header right into that poor guy. Like, she's, like, up and down, and he's reading the paper, and she just... And he doesn't catch her. He kind of just, like, oh, yeah, you know?
Well, she falls into his lap.
Yeah, but he's not even like, oh, are you okay? He's like, ugh, like, just disgust in his voice.
And, yeah, that's Forrest Tucker.
She wakes up, and she insists they must get off the next stop, which is Trollenberg, which is where Forrest Tucker... is getting off the train as well. So that Forrest Tucker plays UN troubleshooter Alan Brooks. Now, at first, I thought he said Albert Brooks, which I thought was really funny because Albert Brooks is a comedian. But anyway, so he's in the same compartment. He's the one who winds up catching her. Anyway, so he's going to the observatory in Trollenberg where he's meeting with Professor Cravett, and where Cravett's asking for his help. So he explains that despite many climbing accidents, none of the bodies have been found. And there's a stationary radioactive cloud that is being observed on the south face of the mountain. Brooks learns that a similar incident took place in the Andes 3 years ago before a similar radioactive cloud vanished without a trace. So rumors start circulating that the locals, that they were living among a cloud and things are shrouded in mist. That evening, Anne is doing her mind reading demonstration when she sees two men on the mountain base camp. And that's going to be Dewhurst. Is asleep. He's the geologist. Now, before that part, that's when they meet Dewhurst and Brett.
Brett.
They meet them. They went up in the hotel bar.
Well, and they're, the lobby,
whatever. And they're going to go climbing, so they have a few drinks. Because nothing says safety like, let me get liquored up before I go up the mountain. Well, he says, I'll bring a bottle of brandy with me. And again, that's the old thing. Obviously, drinking alcohol is not good for you if you're going to go in cold temperatures.
Right. Well, the thing is, yeah, that was the old axiom, is that you would have one for the road to warm your body up. But it actually dilutes the heat in your body.
Yes, it's not good for you. But, and again, they're now on a mountain that had several people die, including people who are losing their heads. Let me have a little liquor because I need to, you know, get it up there. Anyway, so... she sees them at the camp, and so she's able to when she's having her vision, she sees what happens, and she sees Brett seemingly for some reason walk outside. Now, the one thing I noticed here is, and it's throughout the entire movie, no, you can't see anyone's breath. It's ice cold. They're in the middle of, there's no one has any breath coming out of them. Right, doors are left open, windows are left open, but there's no, you know, there's no, like. It's one of those, those. I know you get a bit stickler for like half full, half, you know, half empty, right. You know, kind of thing. Beer or the heads on beer and stuff like that. But no one's ever has like nothing's cold, but it's clearly cold. So Brett walks outside and meets his doom, leaving Dewhurst in the sleeping away. So she faints again, and then Brooks calls up to the hut, but no one answers. So what happens is then they send a rescue party out to look for him. He gets what do you call on the phone, actually. Doesn't he get him on the phone?
Well, he gets Dewhurst on the phone.
And Dewhurst is like, I think he's outside, he's coming, and then the phone is dead. And that's when they send the rescue party up to look for them. So Anne, in her trance-like state, urges the rescuers to stay away. Inside the hut, they discover, because it's locked from the inside, right? So the thing is locked from the inside. They find Dewhurst frozen solid. Right,
yeah.
He's dead and he's frozen solid.
With his head gone.
Missing his head. Right, but he's under the bed. That's the best part. He's just shoved under the bed like a little kid trying to hide his laundry. The spotter plane is going around and circling around, and it finds Brett. And that's when they meet the rescuers. Go up and they find his rucksack sitting there, right, with the severed head inside the rucksack, right. And then Brett shows up and kills him, right. And now they don't know what happened to the rescuers. They don't know what happened to anybody else. So they make their way back to the hotel, and Brett shows up at the hotel, right? And he comes in, and he's like, and he complains about it being really warm. He's all off. It kind of reminds me of in Young Frankenstein, you know, when they're stealing the body, and he goes, chilled to the bone, are you, kind of thing. Like, I always felt like they'd be like, oh, you're kind of a little nippy there, aren't you, buddy? And then he attacks Anne, and it's hard because it's not all explained why he's attacking Anne, but he goes after and tries to kill her. And they manage to somehow subdue him, like, and kind of like beat the living heck out of him. So during the struggle, Brett takes a severe wound to the head, a giant gash in his head, and everyone's surprised because nothing comes out of it. There's no blood, there's no nothing. And they sedate him and lock him away. So they're discussing, you know, the turn of events. Brooks recalls the incident in the Andes 3 years ago had a similar pattern. A man who was murdered, an elderly woman who allegedly possessed psychic abilities to akin to what Anne has. So upon later examination, the killer in the Andes, it was discovered that he was dead for over 24 hours. After 24 hours before he killed the old woman. So the group struggles to understand what's going on. Brett escapes from his cell and continues to try to kill Anne. This time armed with a small hand axe. Before he can do it, he is shot and killed by Brooks. Well, he's shot. I mean, he's already dead, but he's shot. So news arrives that the cloud has begun to move down the mountainside. So that stationary cloud is now starting to move down the mountainside towards the hotel. So the group decides to retreat to the safety of the heavily fortified observatory. As the guests are being loaded in the cable car, the mother realizes her young daughter is missing. And in the thickening mist, the door shoots open, and that's when the tentacles grab the little child. Obviously, Brooks is the one who goes back to save her, and we finally get to see almost 55 minutes into the movie.
The reveal is 66 minutes in.
No, you see it at the door.
No, it's 66 minutes in. When I watched it, I just looked at the clock. It was 66 minutes.
I didn't think it was that long. No, I thought when you see the eye and the thing, he fights it. It's at 50 something minutes.
No, it's 66 when the ball is rolled on the floor, in the hotel lobby, and the door bursts open, and the child looks at the eye. It is 66 minutes.
It doesn't matter. Anyway, but this is the first time you're seeing it.
I think the 66 minutes is important, and I'll get to that in a little
bit. But hiding it this far is why I think this movie being called The Crawling Eye is the wrong name for it. I think that's why, and we'll talk about that. I think the Cholenberg Terror much more has to do with what really is happening here. So a giant multi-tentacled creature that's a giant eye is at the door, and Brooks manages to escape and bring the child with him, and they get up the cable car. Thank you. And then, of course, now it's starting to try to freeze the cable car. And the car keeps jerking to a stop, and they finally get off. And so, obviously, the mist is now where the creatures are. So the mist is where the creature are. And this is where Hans, at that point, right before they're going to go in the cable car, he's the owner of the hotel. He tries to go back to the town. So he gets in the car, and he's trying to drive through the fog. Well, they're up at the observatory. Hans knocks at the door and says, "Oh, I made it out." And he comes in. He's complaining how hot it is, and he's all discombobulated and stuff. And now, since Brett's dead, someone's got to try to kill Anne because someone hasn't tried to kill this lady in the last 5 minutes. They bring in Hans to try to kill her. So once they're in there, Hans finds her and he tries to kill her again, this time by strangling her. And he's strangling her, and then he goes in. And then the thing is, he starts strangling Brooks from behind. Like, I mean, I haven't been strangled a whole lot in my life, but it seems like strangling someone from behind might not work as well. But they realize that the monsters the creatures can't stand heat. So they make up basically Molotov cocktails, right, with their petrol and their rags. And the best is when they're trying to radio out and they're trying to whatever, they open the door and he throws a thing and he misses the first time, right? And he goes, "Give me another one." And he goes, "No, I'll do it." And that's when the other guy goes out and nails it right in the eye. He hit it, and the one on top of the roof grabs him and pulls him up, which is a very famous scene kind of right. thing, you know, because that's what they're known for. And at this point, it's just, there's eye creatures everywhere, you know, kind of thing. And there, then he orders the aerial flame bombing, right? So they order the flame bombing by the
British
Air Force, right? The problem is, right after that, it breaks through the wall. Right? So the creature breaks through the wall, again, trying to kill Anne. Like, they really don't, because they feel that she can give away too much because she's telepathic. She's picking up on their psychic, their telepathy they're using. But now they have a giant hole in the wall, and they're going to firebomb this place. And I'm like, well, I guess we can all huddle in the hallway and hope for the best. So, anyway, the thing set, it hits it, it sets it on fire. Okay, so it forces its way through the brawl. Brooks hits it with a Molotov cocktail. So the monster manages to break through the wall. They save Anne. The aerial firebombing comes through and it kills and tortures all the creatures, and we're left with that. Probably the worst scene of special effects in that movie is the end, when they're all burning. Because it's clearly, no, the scale doesn't work.
Right.
Well, fire and water don't scale well. The creatures are on fire, And the flame, if you look, it's not like a raging fire. It does, it looks like a flicker flame.
Flicker flame
coming up off of models, and it just doesn't work in scale. So that's the brass tacks of this movie, and that's really what happens. And this is why, I mean, this is why I think the Trollenberg Terror works better as a name than the Crawling Eye. The Crawling Eye tells you you're going to see a giant monster movie, right? About this crawling eye and whatever, and it's fine. And there is a crawling eye. But the creatures are they're bringing, basically, they're controlling zombies. Like, they're dead people. They're making walk around trying to kill people. They're using telepathy. It's not just a crawling eye. Like, the giant claw in the last movie was a big bird.
Right?
This is not about just an eye. This is about these space creatures. Right? You know what I'm saying? So.
Well, I believe that when this movie came over from London, or from Britain, the reason it was called A Crawling Eye in the United States was that the Trollenberg Terror was not going to bring a lot of people into the movie. Again, at the time that these, you had to have some catch, and Crawling Eye was it. But I mean, this is more of a mystery than a straight horror story, because you don't see the creature for the longest time. There are scenes that allude to something untoward, but that Anne is clairvoyant and sees doom happening to the various people is part of the mystery of the movie. What I said here was the plot exposition as the movie is progressing is very well done.
Mm-hmm.
There's no lag here. There's no dead scenes. It just keeps building and building. and for Terra and for, again, it's not horror mostly, but for Terra, it's building up.
Yeah, and it definitely plays it straight too. There's no scenes of, like, there's no winking at the camera. There's no nothing. It's all played straight. It's definitely played. I want to say, Hammer did this a lot, and Hammer's later than obviously than this, you know, kind of thing. The Horror of Dracula, Curse of Frankenstein, right around this time. But this is a very British movie. They played it straight. It's played. It's like X the Unknown. It's like Quartermass in the Pit, and like those type of movies. It's played straight.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the British Board of Film Censors actually, I mean, this is there's a note right on the very beginning of the movie before they get to the title, Trollenberg Terror. It says, "No child under 16 permitted in the theater." I mean, this is like an R-rated movie is today.
Yeah.
And again, there's nothing.
This did get a, what do you call it? This did get a Cert X.
Really?
It's got a Cert X.
Okay.
Yeah. Or X Cert, did they call it?
Okay.
And the problem is, again, some of you who know your British film history know about the video nasties and that stuff that came later. But a Cert X, I mean, that was Hammer's. Like, they lived in that area. Like, think about Horror of Frankenstein, like the Horror of Dracula or the Curse of Frankenstein, right? Those movies were both Cert X's, right? They released them here, no problem, but they were Cert X over there because they were just, it's just that level. Any violence or blood or the implying that they're ripping the heads off of people. I think also there's divine, like he's trying to kill her in the movie, so that leads a lot to the what the British felt was happening there. So, you know.
Yeah, the creatures are more than mind control. They've obviously killed the people that are trying to kill Anne, but they've given them the ability to. And again, zombie is a word that I'm sure was around at that time, but it wasn't
zombie at that time. Then it was zombies, like you're thinking, like white zombie.
White zombie, yeah.
Yeah, those kind of zombies. Zombies didn't exist. The word zombie really didn't start happening until the 60s.
But there's no other way to describe this.
Yes, that's what they were. Yeah, so. Actually, what happened was in the U.S., the film was cut down to 75 minutes because they felt that they wanted to get to the monsters faster. And the full running time of 84, obviously, was what was restored to the DVD, which is really hard to get. But it works because
there's a lot more plot exposition.
Yeah.
And you need that. I mean, if you're waiting for the eye to happen, you're going to, okay.
Yeah. This is why this movie is different. Than a lot of the other movies made in the same time, like those B pictures they were churning out, maybe at like Cloverfield or Clover Productions, like Sam Arkoff or even Sam Katzman, guys like that.
Yeah, those American International.
They're 65 to 70 minutes. They had to get the monster on the screen. Like, you saw it, and I think what they were doing here is, this is again, they're telling the entire story, and this was based on a TV series. So, like, it was a serial, I should say.
Right.
So you had to kind of build to the, you didn't give the monster away the first episode. So the John Carpenter actually said that this is the film that inspired him to make The Fog, and because of the creeping the creeping, you know, mass of cloud. And he hid his monsters, and the idea of hiding the creatures in the cloud was what he used in The Fog. Now, and those of you who remember Carpenter's The Fog, not the horrible remake with the guy who played Superman, he hides them in there. Now, in there is not a giant eye monster. In there are the dead coming back for their gold, you know, kind of thing. So, also, the Crawling Eye itself, the monster in the Crawling Eye, literally makes a cameo in Stephen King's horror novel, It. The children are running into the creature in the sewers during a 1958 segment of the novel, and they actually run into it. And that's the actual creature, the eye monster creature. So this was the last film actually produced at the South Hall Studios, which was one of the earliest pioneering studios in all of the UK. The TV serial before it became a film. Both Lawrence Payne and Stuart Saunders reprised their roles from the serial in this one. So they were obviously well-versed in what it is. In the original production, the creatures were called Iodexes, I guess. It's not a word I would normally use. And that Warren Mitchell was actually added to the cast at the last minute because the original choice went on holiday. and the film featured, obviously, it was the first film featured on the first full season of Mystery Science Theater 3000 when it came to cable. Not the Kitmas. Yes, there are Kitmas, I guess, before it. We know that. But when it became a series, this is the first episode. This is the first, actually, Luke and I, having seen this movie when we were younger, said, Crawling Eye, I know that movie. And then they put it on, and they're not making fun of the people in the movie, like kind of just riffing along with it and the situations. And the movie does have situations where you can riff on. It's a giant eye, had its veins and whatever else it might be. Now, so let's talk about the creature itself. The creatures themselves being the eye creatures, they are not, they are clearly just puppeted, not necessarily puppeted, but like the tentacles are puppeted. And they're just superimposed on a screen. There's no stop motion here. There's no man in a suit, per se. It looks like they just filmed someone's eye, really, kind of right. thing, and then like put it on the picture and then did other things around it.
I think they're effective because it does look like an eye. The eye is moving. The iris is actually getting bigger and smaller. And guess what? We just had a phone call.
So we'll be back right after this.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
And we're back! So like you were saying, Dad, about the creatures.
Yeah, I thought they were pretty effective. Even you can't see any wires. The tentacles are moving pretty nicely. And again, as creatures go, I mean, it was exactly what you were expecting—a big eye to be on the screen.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, if we think about this is a British movie. I mean, kind of thing. And I know some people don't maybe think of it as a British movie because it's called The Crawling Eye. It's not like they don't make a big fact. It doesn't take place in Britain. It doesn't take place in England. It takes place on this mountain, right? So it's not like it's specifically there. It's not like Gorgo or the giant behemoth or something like that, where it's very, very British. But not that the effects are bad. I wasn't saying they're bad. But it's not stop motion because it's 58. So in 58, remember, we have Harryhausen's doing his thing. Willis O'Brien just made the Black Scorpion the year before, and he was going to make the giant behemoth. And so they're the kind of things that stop motion was available. Men in suit obviously were available. We knew they had the guys in suits. And again, it's what it was. And to me, The creatures here were, I think, above probably TV level. It wasn't like Lost in Space, or which is again later. I know Lost in Space is later. It's kind of the stuff. This reminded me a lot of like what Irwin Allen would make.
Yeah, the special effects were done by a company called Anglo Scottish Pictures Limited. So there's no names associated with this, so we don't know. It was probably their in-house crew. And at the end of the movie, when the creatures are all over the place, it's obviously a model. And I think it's effective. Yeah. The shots are not, there's not real close-ups of the models. It's a long view, so you see the creatures on top of the observatory and down in the front, and the tentacles are moving. And I think it's as a movie of this sort, it's effective.
Yeah, no, it's not, definitely is. I think the other issue. Again, my issue being that they call it the Crawling Eye. It's not revealed for over an hour. It was an hour into the movie. And the eye itself, being that it's an eye, it could have very well been like just any creature. You know what I'm right. saying? It didn't have to be an eye. It wasn't that the eye was the important part of this. It's that they are aliens and they look different.
Well, I'll bet you any amount of money in Britain.
They call it the Trollenberg Terror. Of course it is. So, and then some of you might think, like, huh, a crawling eye. Now, we've seen this creature, this idea used before. Let's be very honest here. Things that are cyclopses, you know, kind of thing. Like, again, Harryhausen has the definitive cyclops, at least in my book. But we see, like, Mike Wisniewski from Monsters, Inc., you know, is a direct, you know, kind of homage there. But, again, he's got a giant eye and a little tiny body. Kang and Kodos from The Simpsons, again, they're space aliens that are just giant eyes right. with tentacles. And I think that's part of what they're paying homage to. And this is a classic, classic look. Even if you've never seen the crawling eye, you know what the crawling eye looks like. You have an idea in your head. Anyone can picture an eye and having tentacles, which really, they're not really tentacles, isn't it? Just, it's basically the veins.
The veins, right.
From the eye. So it really invokes something different. I'm not sure what the British board saw in making this, you know, a Cert X. But I think they just, anything that wasn't like wholesome family stuff was all Cert X. They, I mean, Horror Dracula, I mean, you know, Curse of Frankenstein, those were all Cert X. Every one of the Hammers were Cert X. And I think that problem was, that's just what it was. That's, but remember, there was no, remember before there was PG-13? Right? Like a movie like Gremlins was PG.
Right.
Gremlins is kind of a hard PG. Not by nowadays standards, but at the time, Gremlins was like, it's PG. Because it certainly wasn't R. And it wasn't like, you know, I mean, that's what PG-13 came from.
Yeah.
I think it just became a situation of not having enough delineation of how you cut things up.
I would have wondered how the Catholic Church would have classified this. I know when we were going to school in grammar school, on Sunday when we go to church, there would be in the lobby of the church before you actually went into the church itself, there was a bulletin board that would have all of the movies that were currently playing or coming out by classification. And obviously, as a young boy, you always looked down to see the ones that were classified C's, because those are the ones that you should not go see. I don't know where this would have ranked. I think maybe one of the scenes in the movie that was probably maybe too intense for the British board was when the little child is in danger. I mean, if Forrest Tucker doesn't get there, that child is going to die. And the child is, you know what, 5, 6, 7 years old?
Yeah, not even, she's a little girl. Yeah.
And so, you know, that could have been one of the deciding factors. But again, there's not much in this movie other than the potential terror of some unknown creature coming out of nowhere to cause havoc and death and maiming. But again, that they're their own. That's their own country, and it's fine.
Well, but think about it too. The Catholic, all the James Bond movies made it on that list, and like things like that in the Catholic Church about like, because anything that had overt sex or overt violence, those are the kind of things. But again, that's again their delineation. What's there by today's standards? These are like fluff. Compared to like this movie here today, I mean, some people might find it boring because nothing happens, because they're waiting to watch a monster. But this has got good story and it leads to what's going on. I think what happens though is every you know time there's a cycle of movies and each decade kind of tends to have that. You saw stuff in the 60s that they got away with in movies. You're like, there's no way we got away with that back in the 50s or the 40s. And even when, before they even had the certifications at all. I mean, remember, a movie like Birth of the Nation was made turn of the century. I mean, that movie's, you know, but it was banned for years and years because of the stuff that's in it. And not horror stuff, but just the way it was done. But at the time, it was a movie they said, well, that's what it was.
But you know, when in the 20s and the early 30s, movie makers were pushing the envelope at that point, where there was nudity and there was violent gunfire and lots of deaths, and that led to the Hays Commission, which then banned a lot of these scenes from movies, and that's how you got into a lot of the musicals and more of the noir type of terror movies.
Well, you saw that too with comic books too. Obviously, EC Comics being, you know, was the worst thing in the world, and they had like the comic code and the whole nine and everything. And again, being on the Two True Freaks Network, you know, comic books are kind of at the forefront of what we do. But the EC Comics, now again, being somebody who was not alive when those were first happening and then reading them all later on, they did not seem anything too, you know, oh my God, I mean, it's a zombie eating a woman. Okay, big deal. Like, it wasn't a big deal, you know, being, you know, a child of the 80s and into the early 90s reading them. But at the time, there was nothing like that. And, you know, when you're pushing the envelope, and I think that's isn't that part of the whole thing, and when you start pushing the envelope, people don't like that. People like the status quo. People like, no, don't make any change, don't make any ripples. And pushing that envelope, I think we see that with Hammer. I think Hammer is the one who says, hey, Universal made these, you know, great classic monster movies, Dracula, Frankenstein, the Wolfman. Horror of Dracula, to me, is the maybe the best Dracula movie ever, because it, like, really, really brings Dracula to what he should be. I can respect Lugosi, you can respect the Spanish version of Dracula, which is actually really good, and anything came after it, but without Horror of Dracula, would we ever have, you know, Gary Oldman, you know, as the old man Dracula, you know, grinning over Harker, or him as whatever. It's all those things that you have to lead to it. So, like we said, this is a great movie. It's hard to get your hands on actual DVDs. On Amazon, this DVD is selling for $30 plus. You don't find it used. Maybe you get lucky and you find a copy somewhere, but the DVD print is beautiful. I myself don't actually own it. I had to watch it on YouTube. Now, it's available on YouTube. It actually has whatever company, I forget what it is, but out there. And it's, you can watch it, and it's an okay version. It's probably nothing more than probably the, I want to say the old VHS,
yeah.
You know, kind of version. And I know that the movie's been restored to the full 84 minutes on the DVD. You might come across the 75-minute version if you're watching an old tape. I would suggest this. If you've never seen it, and it's the only version you can see the 75, it's worth the 84 minutes. The extra plot is worth it. And what happens is, at 74 minutes, the movie might feel leaner, but I think it's leaner in a bad way. I don't think right. they slimmed it down to make it like, oh, a director's cut's too long, like make it shorter. I think they actually took away the 9 minutes they cut. They took away a lot of story that actually adds to the overall experience of the film.
Yeah, I think one of the scenes that is actually added in there, again, in hindsight, it probably is not necessary, is a scene in the lobby of the hotel where Anne is doing a demonstration of her clairvoyance with her sister, Sarah. It's probably...
That's in both versions. That's not cut.
Yeah,
because that establishes her as being telekinetic.
I'm trying to think.
That's cut. Is all the trims in the movie it's these plot exposition. It's them talking. It's the stuff that keeps getting... Because they felt like the people didn't need to know about, like, the relationship that's happening between Anne and her sister. It's all little scenes cut here and there that add up to 9 minutes. It's not like they cut chunks of the movie.
No, but 9 minutes is a long time.
It is, but
80-minute movie.
Right, but the thing is, but like, when they're in the... When they're having the discussions at the bar,
right?
They trim those scenes down. So if you cut 10 seconds here and 15 seconds there, and all of a sudden it's a minute, 2 minutes. The creatures cut.
Right. They probably cut some of the interaction between Forrest Tucker and the professor in his office.
Yeah.
Because the professor says, you're not looking good. And then they go back and forth.
The banter,
The banter.
Well, they clearly know each other because they had that incident that they're referring to where this has happened before in the Alps, but they also had where this happened and they're like, uh-oh. Like that other incident when you called that and they said you were crazy. Like, all that stuff doesn't need to be there.
Yeah, that's true.
But again, it just was them trying to cut it down. They're trying to make this... Remember, I don't have any information about this was double-billed with anything. But let's be honest. We were talking about a time when movies were double-billed.
I'm sure this was double-billed.
I just don't know with what.
I'm trying to remember. Again, it's too long ago. When we would go to the movies to see this, and I'm sure my brother and I went to see this because we would go every Saturday... At the old Burke Theater in the Bronx, and this would have been probably with one other movie like this, and then maybe a Western or a comedy, and then a whole slew of cartoons. But this could not have lasted in any theater on a first run basis by just being by itself.
No, and that's the problem. Again, in 57. You know, 57, 58, 59, all those years in here, they still are double billing everything. Everything's always double billed. And that's fine. I mean, I think part of the great part of those double bills was, you would go see what, like the giant claw, and you would sting your, and then only see whatever came with the giant claw, you know, kind of thing. Or cool too.
I mean, this could have been billed, you know, later on, even with the giant behemoth. You would think that they would be two British movies together. There was also the, what is it, Panic in the Year 5000, where they've got the spaceship buried underneath the. A subway thing, but I think that might have been the early 60s.
Yeah, that's a little later, But still. So, like I said, folks, this is, again, it's out there. You can go see it. It's a good movie. We picked this one for December, because December is usually cold, at least in the Northeast. Oh. So this movie's cold. Even though you don't see their breath, it's cold.
One of the things, again, we didn't discuss too much of the parts of the movie that they don't add or detract from the enjoyment of it. But there are an awful lot of smoking going on.
Oh, they smoke nonstop.
I mean, this is, it seems like, when in doubt, light it up.
Yeah. And, well, they offer cigarettes in the car. Want a cigarette? 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 The girl just fainted. And they're like, want to smoke? Yeah. Right? You know? When they're drinking a lot, too.
Well, but the drinking, you could, I mean, it's in a bar.
Yeah.
But the other thing, too, is that what I remember most as being a kid is that when people were smoking, you never put it out by putting it in an ashtray. You threw it on the ground and you stepped on it. And so there were cigarette butts everywhere, even in the streets where we grew up. And I'm not a big fan. I've never smoked in my life, and I hope no one I ever know smokes. But that always bothered me. And there was one other part of the movie that they at the observatory they had cameras focused on the mountain.
Yeah.
And these cameras were better than the Hubble spacecraft. They could catch a fly on your nose from 8 miles away. When Brett and the other gentleman,
Durst
are walking up the mountain, they are long gone, and they're way away. The camera gets them talking to each other, and that's when Anne has this vision that something is going to happen.
Like I said, folks, it's a good movie. It's out there on YouTube. It might be the truncated version, but it's worth watching. If you can get your hands on the DVD, great. Again, it has this Misty tie-in, and I'll be honest with you, I think it's from Volume 9 of the actual volume, which is long out of print. The Misty copy is beautiful, too. They actually must have used the same copy. Remember, Shout Factory now runs that stuff, but it used to be Rhino, and Rhino didn't skimp on, like, they went and got good versions of the movie. They cleaned everything up. So you knew what you were getting. All right, folks, so that about does it for this episode, and this would be the 12th episode, and I always said they're doing 13. So there's going to be one more episode this year, folks, and it's going to be a holiday classic. Holiday classic.
You want to leave them guessing, Jay?
No. They need to know what it is, because they will be waiting with bated breath to know what's going to happen. We're going to talk about 2005's Santa Sleigh. Yes, the Goldberg as Santa Claus evil demon movie. That's what we're talking about, folks. Santa Sleigh, 2005. Dad and I will be discussing that one next time, and that will be dropping right around Christmas. So when you hear this, right around the 13th. Of December, say, oh man, I can't wait for those 12 days of Christmas to go by so I can have Santa's sleigh.
Joy to the world.
All right, folks, that about does it this time. If you need to drop us an email, it's botsbugsbabe@gmail.com. It's all in the outro. Keep those cards and letters coming in. Keep watching the skies.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Jacknetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Jacknetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots, Bugs, Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Jacknetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?